Accession number 17561, Reel 1.
Colonel Jarvis, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Colchester in 1920.
Can you tell me a little about your family background, please?
I was brought up in India with an army schoolmistress, and went through a village school in Edinburgh, passed my 11 plus to Bishop Wordsworth School in Salisbury, transferred there to Warwick School, which is one of the Headmaster Conference schools, had a place at Oxford, which I had for chemistry, which we had to turn down because my father had no money, and the war was coming. And the alternative was to go to Woolwich, where if you passed out in the top 20% as engineers, sappers, you automatically went to Cambridge. But the trouble was the fees at Woolwich were higher than they were at Cambridge. But just by luck that year, Hall Belisha, Secretary of State, for the Minister of Minister, the War Minister, brought in the rule of means-tested fees. The first time this had been brought in on any higher education started in the army in 1938-39. In other words, if you could get in, your father then paid according to his means, which is the basis of all higher education now. And I got in on quarter fees, and somebody else made the other quarter. And while at Woolwich, in my last term, September 39, war broke out. And the shop, as it was called, the Royal Military Academy Woolwich, what called the shop, I don't know where gunners, sappers and signals went to, closed down. But we were commissioned after a few months into the Royal Engineers, and I then started training my men, became a staff officer, and went out to the Middle East in 1941 with the headquarters of the 10th Corps.
Before we go on to the Middle East, were you in any early bombing of Britain by the German Air Force?
No, our headquarters was in the Scotch Corner Hotel. Pretty safe.
That's in Yorkshire?
Yorkshire, yes.
What, did you run into the enemy on the way out to the Middle East?
No, there's a large convoy which went headed straight for Greenland, I remember that, and it took 9 weeks exactly, 63 days, to get to Port Suez, to Suez.
Which ship was this?
The Langeby Castle, took ship. Not very pleasant for the men down below, not too bad for us, caught at Cape Town. And of course we landed in the heat in August 41. In the canal zone.
Which unit were you in by then?
Same unit, the headquarters, a spare corps headquarters, which is commanded by a lieutenant general with four or five brigadiers as their chief staff officers, and I was the captain staff officer to the chief engineer.
What were your impressions of Egypt once you got there?
Well, the Germans had arrived, as you know, and it pushed us right back to the frontier. And we heard that there had been a change of command. And in fact, we were looking forward to the operations. The idea was to get the Germans out of Libya. Our first job was to build as a reserve the Alamein line in 1941. The headquarters of 10th Corps, skeleton units went up there employing contractors and using the South Africans and some New Zealanders to start building defences round the Alamein station, just in case, as a long stop, just in case the 8th Army had to come back there, which nobody imagined would happen.
What did the work involve as far as you were concerned?
Building roads supervising defences, getting the trenches dug out of the rock, and some sort of overhead cover in places. Headquarters, underground headquarters, really old-fashioned defences in the desert, in a huge semicircle round Alamein itself, and other fortresses going down to the Katara Depression. And that was only 35-mile front, which was reckoned to be pretty safe, you see.
What were the main problems in doing the work as far as you were concerned?
Just recording what was done. It was all as a staff officer, and inspecting the work with my brigadier and looking after him.
Did the enemy attempt to interfere with what you were
doing? Not at all, no. While we were there, the great offensive started, Operation Crusader, I think it was called, November 41, under the new commander, Cunningham. After a bit, drove the Germans back out to Cyrenaica. But as you know, they retaliated pretty soon after, in early 42, and pushed the 8th Army back to Gazala.
How did life in the desert suit you?
It suited me fine. I like, we were near the sea, and we had fairly good rations, we had a good water supply, there was a pipeline laid up alongside the railway, and it was getting a bit cooler in the autumn. I quite enjoyed that.
And what was the state of morale in the 8th Army?
Morale was high. Reinforcements were arriving, and everybody knew there were going to be a big push coming soon.
People seem to say that the 8th Army was rather special. Did you find that?
It was the only army. It was the only army in contact with the enemy in 41.
But people say there was a kind of flamboyance about the army.
Oh, I think so, yes. People were very proud of the 8th Army. See, it was the only one, and Churchill played up on this, you know, his speeches about I march with the 8th Army and all that, which turned into, of course, rivalry with the 1st Army later on.
Any incidents that happened to you at this time?
None at all. I had a very fighting brigadier, Dan Perrott, Sapper. He was killed later on with a rifle in his hands, I believe, who disliked headquarters and offices. And when we went back to Cairo, we slept in the desert near the pyramids rather than going to a hotel or something.
Did that suit you?
I didn't mind at all, no. I remember writing home, sleeping on the sand, looking up and seeing the great stars, Orion and things. I thought it was all the world of good. But I was very much impressed with Brigadier. I did. I thought he was great, and I did what he told me, and I followed suit. Superman he was, very religious. DSO, because he's much very old. I mean, nowadays, but he did his stuff with the Italians, fighting the Austrians on the River Piave, you know, 1917. We sent four British divisions down to stop the rot, and it worked.
What was the attitude towards the headquarters in Cairo amongst the troops at the front?
I don't think the troops thought much about that. No, it was there, and we had to do as we were told. There was this new commander, Auchinleck, had arrived, you see, to replace Wavell. And we called in there and got various intelligence reports and information.
What rank did you have?
Captain.
What happened to you next?
They stopped work after Cyrenaica had been cleared. They stopped work on the Alamein line, and we went back to Damascus, a corps headquarters, to prepare the Lebanon against an attack from the Germans through Turkey, which they thought was coming. The Germans were winning everything then in the eastern front. Turkey was neutral, wouldn't come on our side. So we built defences in the Lebanon and the anti-Lebanon and prepared to blow up the communications leading from Turkey into northern Syria.
Which months were these?
This was through the winter of 41-42.
And what were these defences exactly?
Same thing, getting trenches dug out of the rock, getting roads so we could open up these defences. They were brigade group fortresses, basically. And it was thought that if we held firm on the Lebanon, the Germans would not be able to pass them and get down into Palestine. They would have to deal with that first, having so many troops on their flank. Building the roads was quite a big job. Getting the water supply was a big job. Tanks, reservoirs were built. Headquarters, aid posts. And the job was given to troops resting from the Western Desert. Australians, New Zealanders, and some British. Those who'd been in Tobruk and places, they came back there, had some leave, and then were put into tents in the Lebanon.
How did the forces like doing this job?
Not much, no. I think they were quite pleased to have a rest. But it's rather navvying sort of job, you know. Picks and shovels and things.
And you were with what unit by then?
The same one, headquarters of the 10th, the 10th Corps. At first in a hotel in Damascus, which was really comfortable, and then later in a tented camp in the Lebanon.
And then?
And then in June, we heard that Rommel had attacked Gazala, and there was a feeling of quiet confidence in Cairo, as the expression went. We thought it was going to be all right, the box is holding. And suddenly we realized things weren't right. Brigades were surrendering, surrounded and cut off. All our tanks, were wasted apparently in mad rushes and things. And suddenly the whole 8th Army was in retreat. And we were ordered down with the New Zealand Division and the Australian Division to try and stem the flow. So overnight we moved from our tented camp in the Lebanon and drove all the way down past Cairo, past Alamein, and got as far as Merzimetru, where our corps commander attempted to make some sort of defences. By then the 8th Army was in complete rout. We were surrounded by, we now know, by a very small German force, reckoned to be their greatest success in the desert. I think 1,500 men. And everybody was talking about going in the bag and you can't cope with the Germans, and jokes about the operation order being east with a touch of south in it as soon as you can, and all this. They tried to make a stand. They tried to make a counterattack, which I think went all wrong. The armored division in the desert withdrew without telling the corps headquarters, and we were ordered to break out. My brigadier was killed, his driver was killed, and all my clerks and things, about 10 of them, were captured except me. And I got out in a lorry with a full colonel and a lieutenant colonel on the back of the lorry. Just kept going under the tracer bullets that were being fired, all very high.
Can you give more details of these few days, of what happened to you?
We'd been moved around at night, and anyway, we were told to get out, and I was all for having a go, and just kept going east. Now, this will probably surprise you, tell you what the state was in. As it got dark, I was bewildered. As it got light, I was bewildered by the whole business. I saw a British convoy just pulling up, just beginning to get light, first light, and I drove right alongside it, full of British soldiers, to try and find out where we were and what was happening. And it came to a halt, and I got to the front of this convoy and spoke to the officer and said, "Can you tell us where we are, what's happening?" And he just did this.
Pointed.
I went along to the front and realised it was a German vehicle and they were prisoners. Given in. And I thought, well, none of this. Told the driver to put his foot down, pull the wheel over and keep going, and there were no shots. I could see these Germans, just a Liga. They'd driven into a Liga, and we were free. After a long, long time, I found a British armoured car. Assumed it was British, and we were safe in Alamein.
So this was June 42?
This was the end of June 42. We were completely bewildered. Business. Fortunately, the Alamein line held with the other South African division and the Australians and some Indian troops, and the Germans got no further. We then went back to the Delta, and 10th Corps called itself Delta Force, and prepared to make roads for a possible withdrawal through the Delta. So all these stories you read about Auchinleck had no intention of withdrawing is quite wrong. We had to make roads through the Delta ready for a possible evacuation, capable of taking tanks on transporters. Preparations were made to flood. We had experts down there, experts, British engineers on the flooding. And I saw the orders. If the enemy is not defeated in the present position, it may be necessary to, or it will be, maybe necessary to withdraw up through the Delta, up the Nile. There's no doubt at all that was a contingency plan. Then we heard that Montgomery had arrived and Alexander. And the change was electric, extraordinary. I have more to say about Montgomery later. I mean, I don't think he was all that good a general, but the effect he had then. We heard the whisper word came around, no withdrawal. We stand and fight here. We're going to defeat them when we're ready. Get organized into divisions instead of all this talk about defended OPs and battle groups and everyone split up. Get organized into divisions. And from now on, he said, orders would be orders and not a basis for discussion. You know, effect was absolutely marvelous. That's all they wanted to hear, that we're not going to withdraw. And of course, the reinforcements were arriving. The Highland Division, the 44th Division, and a lot more tanks, and later on, Sherman tanks. Then I was in the Delta at that time and heard about this, of course, the attack by Rommel, Alan Halfa. The end of August, he made his last fling, went right round the Alamein defences to Halfa. Yeah. And they stood firm. This time, instead of rushing around with tank charges, they were told to let the Germans come at them. There were one or two bits of adjustments and things with the greys and things, but our 6-pounders weren't all that bad, you know, and the tanks in sighted positions saw the Germans off, and the RAF were very much better now, apparently getting more and more effective. And Rommel had shot his bolt. Then I was ordered to. I had no regimental experience now. It's quite wrong being picked out as a staff officer at that age. I mean, people my age should have been up with the troops, not in headquarters. And I was ordered to join the 3rd Cheshire Field Squadron about 2 or 3 weeks before Alamein. I knew nothing about the trade, so I was made the second officer as a troop, and I had to take my badges of rank down. I didn't mind at all. I was all for having a go. I talked about getting revenge on my beloved brigadier who had been killed. And we practiced every night, or every other night, clearing mines in the dark. Field Park Company put down dummy minefields, and we practiced this drill. And this was the first time the sappers had got down to a drill for dealing with minefields. A school had been set up called the 8th Army School of Mine Warfare, run by my own OC, my own major, Peter Moore. He'd come back to the squadron then, who ended his career with 3 DSOs, which is not bad for a sapper and an MC. And he invented this idea, this idea of getting the minefield properly taped. You take a slight chance getting the tapes down, and then using these new mine detectors in echelon to sweep 8-foot lanes and picking them up so that the gap was absolutely guaranteed, and lighting it. So we trained and trained. We were all looking forward to this. For once and for all, we're going to put an end to this nonsense. Men were wonderful, I thought, absolutely wonderful. We had some very good officers. They're nearly all from Oxford and Cambridge. So one or two got there afterwards. And the 8th Army was organized into 2 so-called infantry corps. All they had their own tanks, 30 Corps and 13 Corps in the south, and an armored corps, 10th Armored Corps, which was the basis of what wanted to come out from England. I'd come out from England in the corps de chasse, they called it. Effectively, didn't end up like that at all. And off we went. Our job, we knew there'd be 2 minefields, was to follow the barrage, certain bearing, find the first minefield, which a great friend of mine did. I meet him every year now at Downing, met him afterwards at Downing. He did the first minefield, find it. The party of 8, we had two parties of 80 men, took 80 men to clear a gap with this drill, made two gaps there, and I had to go on and find the second minefield, just walking and counting the paces, because roughly where we were, through the New Zealanders. And what hasn't come out in any of the books, as far as I can make out, is that the second minefield was much further forward than they thought. It was in front of the objective, Metairie Ridge. I got onto this, found the front New Zealanders, and they said, "We're staying here on the reverse tape. This is our objective. The minefield is just in front of us. I can see the tripwire." And I didn't know what to do. do we start clearing this minefield in front of the infantry, or what? But my major, Peter Moore, turned up in the middle of all this turmoil, the dust and smoke, and said, "I think if we can get rid of that, there's a machine gun firing at us very high, get rid of him, I think we can go ahead." And the New Zealander says, "We'll go and fix him for you." Brave as can be, a platoon just got up and rushed this machine gun. The platoon commander was hit in the guts, and they carried him back, you know. Very, very brave. They silenced this lot, and they all came back. Meanwhile, I got down to find about this minefield. We were armed with blue bicycle lamps to find them, mark the beginning of the minefield, and the far end on the right bearing, and a handful of nails in case we found one of these dreadful mines which jumped. You see, and you put a nail in, it's fairly safe. The S mines. It was stiff with S mines, which I could see in the moonlight. So badly lay the prongs above the. Above the surface. I managed to stop my major, my OC, walking on one. I know he was very grateful, to keep on repeating that, how grateful he was for that. And then up came the. Didn't see anybody on the other side. Up came the gapping party.
The
gapping party, the 80 men. 4 sappers in front, tied together, with reels on their backs. And the tapes go down, make 3 lanes of 8 feet, pinned down. Behind them, sweepers, two men with his mate sweeping, 8 feet sweep. Now I've got the Cuneo, I'll show you later, the Cuneo print, showing this absolutely intent, absolutely oblivious to the battle that's going on, the terrible noise and all the confusion and the dust and things. And he would do that, say mine, and the mate would put a white cone on it. And they went along in echelon, so if one was hit, the others wouldn't be. Three lots, about 20 yards apart. Then came the disarming party, each man looking for the white cone. Experts in feeling in the dark, finding these things, lifting them, putting them to the side of the gap, side of the tapes. Then the men carrying the pickets, steel pickets, were knocked in. Finally, people with the bicycle lamps, green on the inside, orange on the outside. A bit of wire then to stop people, to channel people into the gap. And the order came to light up these gaps. It was a marvellous sight, like a seaside pier all lit up. And the tanks came rumbling up through this thing, but it was getting light. And they came back again. They'd been picked off the far side. Now this is, I think, the main thing about Al Amin. We didn't start till 10 o'clock at night. The barrage started at 9:40. We had to stay put for 20 minutes. We'd hung around for hours in the dark. We weren't allowed to light any fires after 4 o'clock, just sitting waiting. If only we'd started an hour earlier, or an hour and a half earlier, the tanks could have got right through in the dark, which was the idea, with their supporting anti-tank guns, and take up a defensive position like Alam Halfa. That was the theory. But you just could not get through two minefields at that distance in one night, starting at 10 o'clock, 2200 hours, and nobody dare say so before the battle. Great pity that. So that failed, really. The attack on the Meta rear ridge failed, right, all those efforts. They tried again the next night, by which time, of course, the Germans were fully alert. They didn't get anywhere. There were terrible scenes 2 days after Al Amin. 10 petrol lorries caught fire altogether in harbour. Great blaze, all like a volcano all over the place. Somebody described it next morning. It looked like a badly organised car park at a race meeting. Al Amin. There's so many vehicles, thousands in each division, you know. And after that, it became a real slogging match, what Montgomery called a crumbling process. I don't think it was at all clever, with the whole of the armoured corps mixed up with the infantry, because we had infantry. We had one armoured brigade and one infantry brigade per armoured division. It was called a motor brigade in the 1st Armoured Division. Motor, I don't know why they called it that, with all the 60th Rifles and that sort. We had a complete Sussex brigade, 3 battalions of Sussex, a lorry infantry brigade. A crumbling process, and what that means, well, that means a lot of limited attacks, which is not the way to defeat the enemy, I don't think. An attack was made on one enemy stronghold called Snipe by the armoured brigade, motor brigade, where their colonel got a VC. They didn't hold it, but they managed to destroy, I think, 20 or 30 tanks before they came back, which was a marvellous blow, great morale raiser. They sneaked back afterwards. He got a VC and he was wounded. At the same time, one of our battalions, the Sussex Battalion, had to attack another stronghold called Woodcock. One of my friends went with them to make sure there were no mines on the way and to blow up any enemy tanks and to come back straight away as soon as they got there. That battalion was never seen again. It's just mentioned very briefly in one or two of the histories about Al Amin. Something went wrong with calling up their supporting weapons. They found themselves exposed and hard ground. They fought very bravely, and they had 100 casualties. All they could do was surrender. This was right in the middle of a battle we were supposed to be winning. Complete Sussex battalion was lost. Anyway, we kept plugging away. My job was to get up with a few sappers in no man's land and try to destroy any tanks or guns of the enemies, because they were very good at repairing them. Very often we'd say so many tanks knocked out, and a week later they'd all been repaired in the fluid war in the desert, you see. I'm getting very, very tired by now. We just kept on going.